The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hi, I'm Paco Romain.
And I'm George Chen.
And this is SupDoc, a show where we talk documentaries with guests from the worlds of comedy, film, television, and more.
And we're very pleased to have on today's guest, Tyler Norwood, the director of Robin's Wish.
Robin's Wish centers around the final years of Robin Williams and the confusion around why this comedy icon killed himself in 2014.
After his death, the media narrative skewed the facts surrounding why Williams died. It wasn't until a coroner's report that the complexity of his situation was better understood. He had a severe case of Lewy body syndrome.
Williams' widow, Susan Schneider Williams, has become a champion voice for the little-known form of dementia with Lewy bodies. Showing the frailty of a suffering genius in his last months, Robin's Wish is the first time the public has seen this side of Williams' life.
This story is lovingly crafted by director Tyler Norwood, who has been a guest on SupDoc for his previous documentary, United States of Detroit. Tyler was approached by Susan to tell this story, and his team tracked down friends and neighbors while laying out the details of a fairly obscure disease that is very difficult to diagnose.
And we're pleased to have on SupDoc again, Tyler.
Thanks for being here, and congratulations on the film.
Now I speak?
Now is your...
There's so many half introductions there, like, yeah, and Tyler Norwood's on, and I'm like, oh, hey, God. Nope.
And that's it. Thank you so much, Tyler. Good night, everybody. Yes, now you
so
speak.
So fun to be here, guys.
Oh.
No, it's such a pleasure.
Thank you so much. So, Robin's Wish. First of all, I hate you for making me cry again, all over again. It's an awesome documentary, man. How did this happen? What's the genesis? What's the catalyst?
I mean, man, like, are we going to pretend that you don't have insider information here?
Yes, that's what we're doing. You're just blowing this all up. I love it. Let's peel the layer, man. It's like an onion.
So Susan, years ago came to me about 3.5 years ago, came to me because of a mutual friend who said, you should talk to Tyler. And she'd seen one of my short films that played at the Mill Valley Film Festival called Naples Yellow, which I later found out she showed to Robin while they were in bed one night. And I was like, I couldn't tell you what that meant to me, that the guy had actually seen something I did. I was like, oh my God. And so she came to me and was like, hey, do you want to make a science documentary about Lewy body dementia? And I said, no, not at all. this friend of ours had told me, like, hey, Susan, like, Robin's widow is going to be calling you. And I was like, all right, like, Hank. So I'm like on this phone call being like, where do we start talking about Robin? Like, because I have no association as a big fan of Robin with Lewy body dementia. I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, is this something your grandmother had? Like, why are we having this? And I was like, you know, Susan, it's going to be about 3 years, like 2-3 years, like turns out it's 3.5, before we're actually going to be sitting in a theater watching this thing that is an idea that you're having right now. You know, what is going to sustain you? Because science for me isn't going to do it. Like, I've never done a science doc. It's not something I'm passionate about. And she was like, well, it's something me and Robin went through. And I was like, please tell me those stories. And so then we talked for like 2 hours over the phone about what they'd gone through. And at the end of it, where she'd kind of relayed, she'd relayed information that I'd never heard, number one. Number two, it was super, super compelling. And number three, it was so intimate and got me a huge understanding of who Robin was. And I was like, Susan, if that is the movie, I'm in. I'm all in if that's the movie. But you have to be in it and you have to go there. And so that was, she was not ready for. And she was like, okay, like, let me think about it. And it took us a couple of weeks, but we eventually sat down for some interviews and we were off and running.
So at first she was a little reticent about jumping on board.
Oh, that's an understatement.
Oh, okay.
That's an understatement.
Yeah.
She started thinking she was going to play like the first lady role, right? And she was going to stand back and say, I hereby bequeath this scientific documentary to the public. And I was like, no, like nobody gives a damn about science if somebody's not stepping up.
Yeah.
And I was like, Susan, if you really care, if it really means what you say it means, I need you to do this. And then she went back, processed it all and was like, yeah, no problem.
No, cool.
And then she was the most open, most honest, most brave person I've ever filmed on camera.
Oh, wow. That's a huge statement. That's amazing. I mean, it's not like this happened 20 years ago. It's not like a faint memory. And,
when we were filming this, she was 2 years. Ugh. It had only been 2 years.
Yeah. That's tough.
Yeah.
Were there moments where did you ever have one of those moments? You're like, I don't know. Is this the right thing? Should we be doing
this? Yeah. So I've been doing a lot of interviews, and one of the interviews that the guy I was just on was like, you know, how did you manage the pressure of all this stuff? And like, you know, did you ever just want to be human and sort of like cut the cameras? And it's like, we definitely did that. But at the end of the day, I gave Susan a challenge. I said, if you really want to do something towards your husband's memory, if you really want me to put everything I've got into doing something that sets the record straight about his legacy and who he was on the planet that we now both know that we have the information, you have to do, like, this is what the world is going to need. Because she went out after she got the name Lewy Body Dementia, she went out and she was on the Today Show and she was on all these shows, deaf ears. Because people were like, well, I heard this other thing and now you're telling me this, I got to go to work, right? And it's like, if we're going to cut through that, if we're going to actually get to people, you got to go somewhere that is remarkable. And so when she was in these interviews and she's breaking down and that happened, when she's in that place, I'm saying, let's pause, right? And we're turning off the cameras and we're letting her have a moment. But she's the one who's like, and she's ready to go again. Because she's like, this is not for her. This is not for me. This is for the guy who's not in the room anymore. And that was the thing that I think gave me the energy to say, if she can keep going, I can keep going. And she always, to her credit, was like, this is not for me. It's for us. And I know that Robin would have done this for me if it had happened to me. And like that for me felt so human and so true. And, you know, I think we'd all be so lucky if we had a partner that we were able to find in this life who would stand up for us and step up for us and take this on. Like, I don't know. In that way, I was so impressed by her strength that even in the moments she faltered, I never lost the through line.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So there's the HBO doc that happened, the Come Inside My Mind, I think was the name of it.
Yeah.
So was this at all a response to that doc, or was this something where it was like, okay, like people are getting the wrong information in general and we need to like make sure that we're getting the right information out?
Yeah. I mean, for me, that film was actually being made while we were making this film. And it turned out to be a really kind of reverent biopic, right? It starts at his childhood. It walks you all through the successes of his life. And I think Robin deserves 10 of those. But what nobody was touching was the thing that this film looks to touch on, which is this very difficult, dangerous, scary thing, and how one of the most famous people in history was a victim of it, right? And it's like, how do you do that in a way that balances, you know, fun somewhat at some points? I think we play with the idea that Robin was not a down guy. Like, this was one of the most fun, open, warm humans on the planet. And if you left that out of this story, you'd be missing the plot. So the idea that like we have to let Robin shine and be who he is and then have him go through this hero's journey that I think, you know, the biggest challenges in our life reveal who we really are. Right. And it's like the idea that I think you'd have a really tough argument saying that this wasn't the toughest thing he ever went through. It's a death sentence. And he never got the name of the thing that was killing him. Right. And the idea that he responded to that with strength, kindness and warmth, like he never got angry. He never got bitter. There's no like, you know, like the idea that he never went there, even in the face of the amount of brain damage he was under, which doctors looking at his autopsy said was the worst case Lewy body dementia they'd ever seen. They were surprised he could even walk at the end of his life. And the idea that this guy was like still being there for his wife. They were meditating in the afternoons. They were like the idea that that dude is also the guy that we all love from the movies. I think you can't do anything but walk out of a movie like this and say, Robin the man was even better than Robin Williams, the movie star. And if you thought it was the other way around, you're all wrong.
I mean, after it happened, I mean, I remember just reading how he had done so much philanthropic work and he'd done all this stuff for the homeless. And like, I definitely, it was an impactful thing for sure when it happened. I was thinking for you, learning about the medical side of this stuff, you had to have some advisors on set, right? Some medical advisors, or not on set, but, you know, just to help break down. It's fairly complicated. I mean, it sort of like looks a little bit like Parkinson's.
It
looks
literally a little bit like Alzheimer's. Neurology, yeah. Which is
it is brain.
You need a degree.
Yeah, yeah, brain surgery. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So when you knew that was going to be part of this when you were getting into it, like how it seems like it was going to be pretty daunting. But did you look at like maybe other popular science type films and like relying on animations and stuff like that to like figure out how to like relay the information, or what were you thinking?
This is a thing as a filmmaker that I probably shouldn't admit, but I have some weird thing where I don't like to look at similar things.
right.
Like I just want to like, I'm going to do it my way. And if I'm always terrified that I'm going to finish it and somebody's going to go, oh, somebody did that already. And then I go, oh crap. Like I should have done mountains of research, but I just really trust my gut. And then I feel like whatever comes out from that like my sensibility that you and I could tell the same story and it's never going to be the same. And I'm like, so I always just am like, let's just go forward. But as far as getting some scientists involved in terms of making sure that I'm not just like, you know, telling a story, that was a critical point, right? So here's the order of events. Susan tells me over 9 hours of interview, every insane detail of what they went through in their entire courtship, all the way up through their marriage, all the way up until like this last year and a half of his life where all hell breaks loose. And I go, okay, we got a big story here. Like, this is all news to me. And then it's like, let's go verify some of this stuff, right? Because at the same time, this is a widow. She's 2 years out from her husband dying. Like, there would be nothing wrong in the world. I would hold nothing against her if she got some facts wrong, right? So that's when we went out and we reached out to the Michael J. Fox Foundation, the Lewy Body Dementia Association, the American Brain Foundation. And we said, like, can you guys verify some of this science? Can you walk us through? Can we get some of your experts who are neurologists, like the most respected in the world, to verify some of these things? And that was the journalistic side, right? Like, the filmmaker side of me was so excited to launch into this like love story that like there's like this villain and Robin's fighting to stay alive and stay present for his wife and all the, you know, but the journalist side of me was like, you better get every detail right. Cause if you screw up one detail that's fundamental, it's all for nothing. Mm-hmm. So that was, in the end, we had organizations that represent over 50,000 neurologists sign off on the science of the film.
Yeah, and there were some scenes where you had like someone with a projector like over them, and like that seemed to work for me as well. Like, I think I got it at the end of it. I'm like, I think I understand what this disease is. Like, if you got through my dumb brain, this is gonna work for
not easy.
Yeah. No, I mean, it. And the idea of like, what's crazy is when you talk to these scientists, they immediately want to take you into the most granular, like cell level things, and you're like, no, I might care about that because I'm just like super curious, but I have to remember there's like, you know, there's a George Chen in the audience being like, dude, what are we talking about? Why are we like looking at alpha synuclein proteins in the brain? Like, where did Robin go? Wasn't this a movie about Robin Williams? And so it's like balancing that was very difficult to get to that point where we've given people what they need to know, but like, it's not a science documentary. It's a documentary about what Robin Williams went through, and his journey was not a scientific journey. His journey was something that like, a medical thing happened to him, but it was really the way he responded to that, the way that his friends were with him through that, the way that his wife and he struggled through that, like all of that stuff. Like, you could just say he had terminal cancer. You could insert anything into that place. And it's like, it's about what he did because of it, not because of the science. But it was important to know what that villain is in the film.
I mean, he also ironically played like the most famous neurologist like ever, right? Oliver Sacks. Yeah. Did you think about trying to use clips of that, or could you not get the rights to the clips? First of all, yes,
we thought about using clips. Yes, we almost did use clips in previous cuts because it's just too amazing that he plays Oliver Sacks. But I will tell, like, the moment early on when I was like, Awakenings, and then I was like, fuck, Oliver Sacks is dead. I was devastated for days when I realized, we can't just go interview him because how amazing would that be? He played Oliver Sacks, and then Oliver Sacks is talking about
this total like loop. Yeah, that would have been great.
I was so bummed out. And I know that Oliver Sacks and he had this beautiful friendship because Robin was really actually in his own private life, super interested in the brain. Like there's points in the movie where he's literally talking about like brain science and he's on a talk show in Australia and they ask him like, well, if you, like, and they're not talking about the brain in any way. They're talking about, he just got married to Susan and they're talking about his work with the troops. And then they go, hey, you know, if you hadn't been a comedian, what would you have done? And he's like, well, I would have loved to have been like a neurologist. And you're like, like that's what his, you're just, I mean, and the idea that like, it's just the dude was literally a genius who just happened to decide that the best way to be in the world for him in his own particular color was to be a comedian, an entertainer, you know, an actor. And it's like, but he could have easily done anything else.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And it comes through. I mean, it really does come through too. Like his like smart, sensitive side that he has, you know, like comes through in this doc. Cause you like, I don't think a lot of people know, they think of comedians, I think of always being on, you know, you're always on the on button's going and you're just the life of the party on and off stage. But like most comedians I've met are quiet, introspective little unicorns, you know, they're special, yeah. Quiet little people off stage. And then we see Mike Pritchard, who I'm so glad that you got Pritch in this doc.
Pritch.
I love Mike so much. He's such an awesome large man. And he talks about
and nuts, just completely nuts.
I am shocked he didn't do the elephant noise.
Oh, he did all the noises. I had to cut that out.
I'm sure.
He doesn't know or care how that would make him look.
That's awesome. His story is incredible too, man. He's got his own personal journey through comedy and then like speaking for kids, bullying campaigns. Like he's done some amazing stuff. He's in that documentary Happy. Have you ever seen that doc?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I watched it randomly on Netflix and I was like, fucking Pritch. This is awesome. Look at that guy.
But that's where the thing about Mike Pritchard, I mean, we're kind of like, I think there was a question you started,
yeah,
but like,
that's right.
Just a quick note on Mike Pritchard is like a beautiful human being, right? Like this is a guy as a comedian, like he's not doing a Netflix special anytime soon, right? Like this is a guy who's like a gamer, right? Like he's in and out. He's on the field and off the field. And he's going to be that way until the day he dies. He does it out of the love of the game.
Yeah.
Right. And the idea that Robin had a lot of friends who are comedians who are just love of the game guys, like that, you know, that told me so much about who Robin was as a dude, that he wasn't like, oh, you're doing like a Tuesday night at the Oakley. Like he was like, you're doing the right thing for the right reason. And you're my guy. And one of the things that I think he and Mike bonded over even more than that is that Mike is like, you know, Mike could have probably gone on and done things that would have been more commercially successful, but he chose to try and be of service. And I just from what I know of Robin through talking to his friends and some of the stories that I've heard, like that's what Robin respected. Was people who like chose the thing that served others. And that's actually how our movies end, is with Robin talking about service to others as being kind of the highest form.
Yeah. Well, and when you told me, like when we went out for beers after the United States of Detroit and you told me about you had, I think, just started talking with Susan and you talked about the book and the inscription. And now that's in this doc and it's so heavy. It's such a beautiful moment, and it's such a beautiful opus, you know, or a coda, if you will. I'm just going to throw out some music terms on the doc and in Robin's life, which I want to help people be less afraid. Like that is talking about to be in service of others. Like that is a beautiful, beautiful thing, because like, you know, Robin was my personal hero. Like there was no one that I loved more than Robin Williams as a kid, growing up, teenage years, college. That's why I moved to fucking San Francisco, essentially, was because of Robin Williams. And like my weird trajectory followed Robin in a very strange way as well. And like his whole idea of not wanting people to use fear as a demotivator, you know, is such a wonderful thing. Like, I mean, and that plays in so much into this film. I mean, you can see that arc of like where Robin's at and what he's doing. And that then you hear about all those things like George was mentioning earlier, like people have those tales they tell of like Robin being like, hey, we shouldn't throw away craft services food. Let's feed the fucking homeless with it, you know? Like that kind of stuff is truly, it's remarkable. And it's like, I don't remember who says it. I think it's Stanley Wilson mentions in your doc that Robin could have just rested on being a millionaire star. Like he didn't have to do anything. There was nothing on his agenda that it was like, you need to go out and do this. No, he's in his 60s. Like, at that point, you kind of just rest and you're just like, you know, I'm fucking Robin Williams. Like, this is like, I just sit around now and pet my tiger, you know?
Yeah, I hit Mel Brooks status a long time ago. I can hang out.
Right? Right. Yeah.
And but 63 still feels so young when I'm watching this, is the thing I'm like realizing.
Oh, so
like,
young.
Yeah, because I've known him my whole life, it feels like. So just to be like, oh man, I've known this guy my whole life. So in my mind, he's like, he's not even as old. He had that beard for a minute where he really got that Letterman beard. I'm just like, but 63 is not even that old, which was like,
with the energy that dude walked around with every day, like, he could have been 75 and still like made us look old.
Like,
right?
Dick Van Dyke style. I wanted to like, you know, expect like a Dick Van Dyke life.
Yeah. Had you ever met him, Tyler? Did you ever meet Robin?
I never got to meet him. That was the crazy thing, right? I'm in Marin. I'd have every friend I have here in my little town was like, oh, I'd see him on his bike. Like, oh, you know, my friend cut his hair. Like, oh, I saw him at lunch one time. It's like,
yeah,
no, I never caught him. But like, I think I mentioned the fact that he saw some of my work, that was enough for me to be like, okay, I'm good.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I've had a couple weird run-ins with Robin. One was though at the, at a Sketchfest show, my sketch comedy group did a show, and then Robin came backstage with Rick Overton. And when they came backstage, the entire crowd just followed them, and they came backstage, and there was a bunch of people, and then me and the rest of the comedians were basically in the corner, be like, nobody wants to talk. Literally, like half of the Talking Heads band was there, George Carlin's daughter. Like, there's all these cool ass people, and Robin saw us just in the corner, be like, no one wants to talk to me. And he came over and was like, can I hang out with you guys? And he's like, I want to hang out with some comedians. Like, yeah, come over here. It's awesome. It was one of those things where you're just like, this guy doesn't have to do any of this stuff, but like, here he is, like, wanting to hang out with comedians, you know?
And that's the story. Like, the cool thing is, you know, Paco, you were helpful to us. At one point, this movie was going to be in 600 theaters, and we were trying to put together like a little promo package for the theaters. And we did a little interview with you, and we did it with a bunch of other comedians, just kind of like, we wanted to put something together that would be like, you know, who Robin was to the comedian community that an audience could connect with. And there was so many stories like that, like, just like, oh, like, you know, this guy Brett Ernst is like, we were hanging out in the parking lot of the Comedy Store, and Robin shows up at 2-3 in the morning and hung out with him for like an hour.
Yeah.
It's like, it just, we all know how famous Robin Williams was, just kind of like somewhere we just understand that a guy like that is as famous as you can literally get. And the idea that he's just like hanging out with dudes at the Comedy Store in the parking lot at like 3 a.m. is like, you just can't get any more human than that.
No.
I also just love that he's like regularly just hangs out with Mort Saul every day. Like, that's like, I'm like, how did Mort Saul outlive Robin Williams? This is insane. You had to go interview Mort Saul, right? Because I think there's a clip of that we could show.
Yeah, exactly. No, there's so one of the things that Robin lost his father like earlier in his life, and he kind of collected these father figures, like Jonathan Winters at one point.
Jonathan
was,
Winters. Kind
of putting on that level. And then like Jonathan Winters passed, and he had this, and then he eventually settles, you know, him and Mort Saul developed this intense, great friendship, right? Like, two incredible minds that can connect to each other and have had similar experiences enough to where like they can really connect. And then like, you know, it's just that part of it is really powerful to me, that like someone who Mort Saul he might still be doing it, but up until a year ago in his mid to late 90s is still doing a Thursday night comedy set. It's like Robin was on that level. Robin was not doing this for the fame, for anything else. He just wanted to be a part of a conversation if he got to be at the front of the room cracking jokes, like that's where he would have been until his last day, if he'd have been able to be in control of it.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, what I thought, one of the things that really stood out to me that was surprising is, I don't remember the doctor's name. I don't know if it was Dr. Miller or not, but they said that because of Robin's brain, the way that it worked, the fact that he was so smart and using, I guess, many facets of his brain, that this disease didn't destroy it quicker. That's insane.
It's an important, and it makes so much sense, right? Like that connects to you immediately because you're like, oh, I get that. So it's an important scientific concept, which is the idea of cognitive reserve, right? Like the idea that like essentially, if Arnold Schwarzenegger in the 90s gets MS, right? Like some like thing, he's jacked, right? Like to the max, he's Mr. Olympia, right? And it's like, it's going to take a long time before that disease wears down that giant hulking thing. Whereas if me or you get it, we're done. Like we're right. done. Like 2-3 months, like we're done, right? Like, but Arnold's going to last a long time.
I'm not the getting cool 3 months.
Maybe less. You know, but the idea that Robin is that's how intense and powerful his mind was. That like it took this long for this deadly, untreatable, like neurological disease to wear him down. And the idea that on autopsy, doctors were like, this guy shouldn't have been able to walk. He definitely shouldn't have been able to be like talking to people. And he was doing all those things right up until the end. It's like,
yeah, that's insane. I mean, just knowing a little bit about the schedules of movies and TV shows, and he was doing both at the same time. Like, that's insane. That
with
takes
this. With this.
With this horrible disease.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Like, I believe it's Sean Levy, or is it Levy? Sean Levy?
Levy.
Sean Levy is talking about, he's the director of Night of the Museum, and he's talking about when Robin says, like, I'm not me anymore. I don't know what the fuck's going on, but I am not me anymore. And to me, that is super poignant. I mean, that, just imagine, like, knowing that something's wrong, and you're just like, what the fuck is happening? What is it? What is going on? You know?
Imagine being Sean Levy on this damn movie set, right? Like, you're on a mega, like, just a mega, this is the third one. The previous one made $1 billion.
Right.
And one of your stars is gone. And he's calling you, like, Robin's calling Sean Levy at 2, 3, 4 in the morning going like, is any of this working? Like, I'm not me anymore. And Sean's like, you are still you. Like, you're Robin Williams, man. Like, and it's like, but Sean's inside going like, uh-oh. I don't know what's happening either. Yeah. Right. Like that's the thing where this thing created a lot of trauma, right? Like David E. Kelly had the same amount of trauma inside of like, this was a secret that they weren't allowed to share. And Hollywood has a really rich tradition of keeping secrets. Right. And the idea that like, this felt like something they were like, well, if we're loyal to the business, if we're loyal to our friend Robin, like you don't let anything out, you never tell this story. But it changed the narrative. And so the cool thing was that this film, by getting 17 people together who really knew him to come forward, then all of a sudden Sean Levy's not talking out of school anymore. He's part of a movement. David E. Kelly isn't talking out of school anymore. He's part of a movement. And these guys are really, they're getting to unload something that like they didn't want to hold anymore.
Yeah.
Right? Like Sean Levy says, like, you know, it felt more loyal to tell the truth than to keep the secret. And it's like the idea that he can feel loyal again, and he doesn't have to feel like maybe he's doing this out of fear because he doesn't want to talk out of school. Like, I did see a lot of people during the making of this film who loved Robin and really were in his life in different ways, be able to have this like weight taken off just because, you know, a secret is a terrible thing.
I got a phone call. It was Robin. He was up in Vancouver and he was working on Night at the Museum 3. And he was having a panic attack and he could not calm himself down. He's having such a struggle remembering just one line.
Your life depended on it.
Say that. It wasn't enough that you took his head
off. He got very frustrated. I remember him saying to me, I'm not me anymore. I don't know what's going on. I'm not me anymore. His mind was not firing at the same speed. That spark was diminished. The joy was sometimes not there. I had to work harder editorially to create it on screen because it wasn't always there in the same way on set. And I didn't resent that. It was more taxing. It took a lot more time and energy, but if that's what my guy needed, then that's what I was going to give my guy.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about all from the comfort of your home isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The presumption that everyone has is immediately in August of 2014, before this coroner's report is out or anything, it's sort of like these sad clown kind of memes going around, like the genie and stuff like that. So like, and everyone just says it has something to do with the rumors that just are swirling around have to do with like sobriety, or like maybe he's not, maybe it's a drug thing. Maybe it's just like related to the heart surgery. And I think, like you said, a lot of people just like, they just get that one bit of information, then they don't dig any deeper into the story. And I think that was what a lot of people assumed. And I was just thinking about, like, if that is how most people perceived it, they just think it's like, you know, like I guess a conventional suicide would be a bad way to phrase that. So I shouldn't say that. But it just like the complexity of what you're saying in the film is basically, and I think there was one quote that I really latched onto, this concept that things are either psychological or biological. And then they were like, it's not that simple. It's this combo thing. And so I think that was like maybe the nuance that got lost in that entire discussion. I think you guys are really trying to address that.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, Paco, as a, you know, verified comedian, like this is a little bit of like, I mean, honestly, you almost should answer this more than me. But the idea of like this narrative of comedians being like these like really like boisterous, fun people. And then like when they're off stage, though, not only are they like, to your point, Paco, like generally more quiet and like actually human, right? They're not like, oh, like that's not 24 hours a day. Like one of the things that Robin Williams reported, like in a couple of interviews, like one of his little go-to bites when somebody would ask him, does it ever get tough to be famous? He'd recount this story of being in an airport in Dallas and somebody coming up to him and going, be zany, right? And he was like,
ah, fuck you.
That's not the game. No. Like this is not, you know, you're missing the whole deal.
Yeah.
And like, so the idea that like comedians are supposed to always be zany for the culture, right? And we think that if they're not that, that they're somehow darker and like tortured, and that somehow that gives us license to, well, it's actually good that I'm not funny. Otherwise I'd be like, you know, suicidal. And it's like, what a shitty thing. What a shitty thing to have out there as a narrative.
Or like,
and it's
all like, kinds, you know, of art. Yeah, like all that creativity and depression are inherently linked. And like, you know,
right. And you can find music, some excuse art, as a person who doesn't endeavor to do that. Like, well, you know, that's a whole life that's difficult. It's like, you know how happy Robin Williams was? You know how much joy he had in the world? And do you know how hard he fought to stay present through his darkness? Which, guess what? Whoever's thinking that, you have too, right? And it's like, the idea that there's some sort of like, you know, like the Chris Farleys and the Jim Belushis of the world, right? That those are actually really bummer stories about people who, like, you know, you wish they would have found more resources. You wish they could have found more tools to be around longer. But Robin did that work. He was in that clamp. And when he was around, when Jim Belushi went through that, he was in the room that night. He was like, I'm not doing this anymore. And he switched, and he got off everything. He started doing bicycling, actually, which we touch on in the film, that like this was a proactive guy who wanted to be here, and he did the work. And if you don't give him credit for that at the end of his life and try and write him off as somebody who didn't have those resources and didn't do that work, you've really done a disservice to the memory of this guy.
Oh yeah, completely. I mean, the story of it's mind-boggling how the Robin Williams story starts, the middle, the act one, act two, and act three. I mean, it's really quite incredible. Like, it's almost like it's one of those, like, you couldn't write that, you know, like it seems beyond fiction. I mean, it's just like, especially, it's kind of like, I'm a huge jazz fan, like Freddie Hubbard, one of my favorite trumpet players, ended up getting lip cancer. So he couldn't play trumpet anymore. I mean, of all the things to get cancer as a trumpeter, the lip is probably the last place you want to get it. And that's what happened. They had to do surgery. They had to take some out facial stuff and he couldn't play anymore. I mean, the fact that Robin, who is heralded as this quick thinking, witty, off the cuff improv genius, ends up having a problem with the brain. It's just like, you can't write this kind of ideas, you know? And like, for me, like watching this doc, getting to know more about his personal side, I know a lot about Robin because he's my hero. And I,
you read that book.
Yeah. And the Dave Itzkoff book, which is a great book. Did you end up reading that?
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's a great book. And I learned a lot from that, but just like, you know, learning more, like knowing some of his friends and hearing from his friends and like getting to be filled in all this. But so my question to you is like, what is something that, were you surprised by some of the things that you learned about Robin? And follow-up question, does that open up to you? Did you gain a more of a appreciation for comedy and comedians in general and the craft?
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll take the second part first or the first part second.
All right.
In order to like really appreciate Robin, you had to understand comedy, right? Like I had to, like, I went and hung out with this guy, Johnny Steele, like, and we, like when he did like an open mic night and him and it, and it's just like, you know, you get to know these people that Robin knew and you see this kind of way that they're all sort of like, just kind of like dudes. It is a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing that somebody who has an instinct to make the world a better place and does the work to be present and show us all like, hey, the world's not quite as scary as maybe you think it is. Like, beautiful, beautiful. Right. And it's like, you know, and a lot of these, like, I mean, I would say the majority of comedians are not making a ton of money off this. Right. Like, so the idea that, like, you know, just like any other craft, it has to be first done out of love. And then you start understanding Robin, right? And then you start having, no, this is the first part. And then you start understanding the power of who he was as a human, that this is how he wanted to express himself, right? Like, he always wanted to be an actor. His dad was in the automotive industry and told him he should pursue like a very structured career. And his dad was a huge executive, could have probably gotten him one of those jobs. And Robin could have been the CEO of like GM, who knows, like, but that was not what he wanted. He did the hard work. He went to Juilliard. He pushed himself and he became somebody that we all remember as one of the great lights in our lives. And it's like, those are the things that surprise you as you learn about this guy, is that like, he made these choices. Nobody's accidentally hilarious. Nobody's accidentally, you know, an amazing actor. Nobody's accidentally any of these things. These were choices that he made. Nobody's accidentally generous. Like, he pushed himself to give to the homeless, to be there for troops at their bedside when they were coming back from the battlefield, right? Like, those are the things that surprise you, is all the choices that he made that make him Robin Williams to us, but that the guy Robin was just doing out of instinct.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it makes me wonder, I don't know if you have any insight on this, but was there, did Robin have projects that he was looking forward to making kind of pre-symptoms?
Yeah. Okay. So really excitingly, I mean, this is like, let's see who knows this. So Gus Van Sant came out with, I Don't Think He'll Get Far on Foot, and it's Joaquin Phoenix in a wheelchair, that film.
Yeah.
Robin had bought the rights to that book and had planned to play that role himself. And him and Gus, who directed Good Will Hunting, were going to do that movie.
Wow.
Like, with Robin playing a just messed up alcoholic, which he'd been, right? Oh. He was going to go there. And he was excited to do that and just never got a chance.
Oh, wow. Oh, man, he would have been great. Anytime Robin had a beard for a role, those are the, like, that's the ones you could really dig into.
That's the trope, right?
Yeah, that was the trope, man. Put the beard on, you got a different Robin Williams. Do you have a favorite Robin movie?
Oh, man, that's the thing. I've definitely had that question like 100 times. And I think the thing that's important as like people who are just like, we're all roughly in the same age range, is the idea of like, he was there when we were 5. He was there when we were 6, 7, 8, 9. It's like, you can't pick, like, if I had to pick just like off the top, I'd say What Dreams May Come. But that doesn't begin to encapsulate what he meant. Right. Like, Hook for me meant more to me in my life at a point than What Dreams May Come, which might be my favorite filmic film. But like, you know, Hook was incredible. You know, Jumanji was great for me. The idea of like when, you know, we were all like pretty young actually when Good Will Hunting came out. Like we were all like 11 or 12, but it feels like that's a movie that we can remember now, right? Like, but it's like we were kids like for the most part when that movie came out, but all of a sudden we felt like we knew about what it was like to lose a wife, and we felt like what we knew what it was like to like sort of understand great loss. And it's like, and that was all through his, like that was through him.
Yeah. For me, it was World According to Garp. That's the movie I saw where I was like, holy shit, what is this? Is Mork? Like, what is he doing? This is awesome. You know, like The World According to Garp. Like, I loved that movie when it came out. And then that's one of the things that really got me interested in Robin. And then seeing his Live at the Met stand-up special. I was like, what the fuck? How does this guy do this? Like, it's insane. You know?
Yeah. A few years ago, I checked out the special he did at the Great American Music Hall, partly just because I wanted to see what that looked like at that time when they would put the tables out, and it's like basically the same building. But yeah, he was just so prolific, just worked so much, such an incredibly hard worker. But I was thinking about this, and this isn't from your thing, is more like some research I was doing after watching the film. I found a video of someone who's very who's diagnosed with Lewy body and is like, but is pretty really smart. Like, she's like a nurse. She was like talking about her whole situation. She could really articulate like what was happening to her, and like having that knowledge obviously is like, that's the big missing piece here for Robin. But I was even thinking about the resources that are available to someone who was worth tens of millions of dollars versus like just your average person. This is a disease where apparently it's like more expensive to treat on average than Alzheimer's because of like the amount of like people just fall down and stuff all the time. And but even being able to catch the diagnosis, do you think like before this film, like most people had only heard of Lewy body syndrome after Robin died. Like I was definitely in that camp. It just sort of like is so, it's one of those things. It's kind of like, you know, in the beginning of COVID, how people are like, well, it kind of looks like the flu. It kind of looks like this thing. You're kind of like dealing with like symptoms that are so close to other things that it's really hard to diagnose. But like this person in this video was talking about how she basically had to, you know, get rid of all her money so she could get on Medicare. And then that took like 18 months. So basically you don't have like a buffer. And I'm just like, most of us are not worth tens of millions of dollars. Like, what does this say about like the healthcare system? Is it more like we have to put money into researching this particular thing? Or is there just like more that has to be done in terms of like just supporting people? You know, not to, we always get into political talks, you and I.
For a single payer plan?
we get into this. I'm like, well, how does Canada deal with Lewy body syndrome? That's what I was trying to Google. I could not find like, what does the UK do? But in the UK, it's still like super not well known either. It seems like it's just kind of coming into its own as like the number two thing after Alzheimer's that happens to old people.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that, so it's a disease on the spectrum of Alzheimer's and dementias, the same way that Parkinson's is, and so they actually are very closely related. But in regards to what you're saying, it's like the tough thing about, so there's a little caveat, which is the idea that like, yes, Robin had more money than he needed in order to get the best care, but the issue is that's crazy is no doctor wants to be the one who tells Robin Williams. So actually, one of the things that Susan says is that, you know, they didn't get the best care and they didn't get the worst care, because actually doctors were kind of just wanting to be like, no, you're good. You're Robin Williams. You're good. Right. And it was like, they were running like kind of, you know, like, oh, we're going to test your pee and we're going to blah, blah, blah. And like, but like, nobody was saying like the way that maybe if a person would just like a regular person came in where they'd be like, all right, well, you know, we want to send you to this inpatient clinic for a couple of weeks. Nobody wants to tell Robin Williams' people he's got to come off the road and like do X, Y, and Z. And so it's like, you know, you just every case is different, and it just I think it sucks being old in America as is, right? Like, it just the healthcare is not there, right? And it's like I think that's just something that is unfortunate. But what we can do, and what is happening in Robin's name, is finding a biomarker so that more people get diagnosed. Because at the end of the day, it's a death sentence, and there really aren't any cures or treatments or anything. There's nothing that's been developed. So what's important is if you can get more people diagnosed, they can at least know what's happening to them, which I think is a huge mental victory. If you can walk through your life knowing, hey, I've got cancer, hey, I've got heart disease, and you're not mm-hmm. just like, why is there blood in my like when I blow my nose, right? Like right. you know what's happening, and that changes the way that you approach every day that you're kind of working through this. So that's what I would say, is that at least through Robin's memory and the idea that he's highlighted this disease, people are donating to science. Mm-hmm. Those scientists are looking for this biomarker, which would allow them to then do a scan while you're alive that would make it much easier for you to tell if somebody had Lewy body dementia or not, which doesn't currently exist. And it's very, very difficult to diagnose.
So a biomarker, is it like a genetic test or something? Do we think it's a genetic disease, or it's like they're not even that sure like what the origin is? Because it's like on that spectrum of stuff.
Yeah, you're getting into high science here. So now you're getting into the concept of alpha-synuclein. So alpha-synuclein is this chemical that's in our brains, but it's also everywhere else in our body. And if you have a buildup of alpha-synuclein, it can create these Lewy bodies, which are basically clumps of alpha-synuclein mm-hmm. that choke off parts of the brain. So imagine like you have this beautiful clear stream, and now all of a sudden there's all this mud in the water. Well, like, you know, at some point that mud can turn it to where all of a sudden the sand is, the water's no longer clear. And that's what happens with Lewy body dementia, is like, you know, these things start taking up space in your brain, and they're actually choking off. And it's no longer are these connections free flowing and clear. It's like all of a sudden now, like this part is broken. And so your brain's trying to work around it. And then this part breaks and your brain. And so it's just like this idea of, you know, just breaking up this natural flow. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. the biomarker tells you if there's a lot of alpha-synuclein in your body, and that gives them a good sense of like, oh, wait, we should really be looking at some things that, you know, Parkinson's mm-hmm. also would do that. But Parkinson's, if you're doing this, people kind of go, oh, your hand's shaking. Let's really look at that. But with, mm-hmm. with Lewy body dementia, you don't get those symptoms until the end, which is why
they're also, because it's like hallucinations, it's like internal types of like, yeah, there's a mix.
Well, now you're getting into something. So the concept of hallucinations, which we, for a fact, know that Robin was having, but mm-hmm. he never told Susan exactly what was going on. He'd only hint that he thought maybe she was cheating on him. But then we have some report, well, I shouldn't even say that on here. It's speculative, right? We don't know what the hallucinations were. Mm-hmm. But we know that just by the damage done to his brain by Lewy body dementia, that was something he'd been having for a very long time. And they become more vivid and more graphic as it progresses. And the idea is that, like, Bruce Miller, who's in the film, who's one of the world experts on Lewy body dementia, reports that, like, these hallucinations are not like, oh, my dog's back and I thought my dog was dead, but my dog's here. It's stuff like, he was like, when I talk to patients of Lewy body dementia, he's like, the average thing, and he was like, Tyler, let me level with you. He's like, the average hallucination that this disease triggers in your brain because of the way it attacks your brain and where it affects your brain, he's like, usually it's the stuff like one guy thought that there was an army on his front lawn murdering children. And you're just kind of like, the idea that Robin was able to have these mm-hmm. kinds of things and sort of move forward is powerful. What is tragic is that because of the way we look at mental health in this country and in the world, he felt shame about that. He felt like mm-hmm. if he said that out loud.
Okay. Yeah.
He might be seen differently rather than a guy who's struggling with something,
yeah.
a guy who isn't himself anymore. And that's very dangerous. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's something that's really powerful. And the idea that even actually when he gets his Parkinson's diagnosis at the end of this whole thing, so he's having vivid hallucinations, probably on a daily basis, maybe more often, right? I'd have to check exactly with the medical experts to find mm-hmm. out if they can pinpoint frequency. But the idea that this is certainly a part of his life at this point is he's having vivid hallucinations. So the doctor goes, you know what, Robin, like you got Parkinson's, but hey, like it's early, you know, you're going to live for another 10 years. And Robin goes, okay, but am I schizophrenic?
Right.
And the doctor goes, no, you're good. And like the idea that doctors now, knowing that he had Lewy body dementia and that the last thing you see is Parkinson's, right? Like you start having those tremors, you go the opposite way. So you start having tremors at the very end. The idea mm-hmm. that like a doctor was saying that and that was not what he needed to hear, that didn't make any sense to him. And you know, his wife's like, oh, you're okay, like it's just Parkinson's. And like the idea that he's like, no. And so the idea that doctors and medical experts now have that quote of like him asking, are you sure I'm not schizophrenic, when somebody says, do you have Parkinson's, like it clearly, right, if that doctor or if medical science had done more towards understanding this disease, that would have been a moment where you go, whoop, let's move this guy into the other part of the medical equation.
Doesn't he straight up ask if he has dementia? I thought that was even in, there's a quote, right? From Susan, she's like, he asked the doctor.
He's like, are you sure I don't have dementia? But dementia is where somebody can be like, oh, you know, like who knows what that, mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. like if someone comes to you and goes, hey, George, I think I might be schizophrenic. You don't go, no, that's, you're good.
Yeah, right. That's hallucinations. That's like voices. Yeah, that's all that stuff. Yeah.
I can't tell what's real anymore. And you go, no, mm-hmm. you're good.
Get out of here, you crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're Robin Williams.
You're like, Robin.
You know. Do you think the people just kind of wrote some of the heart surgery stuff off into this too? Or no? Do you think that was like I guess that's more of a medical question again. I keep asking you medical. You're a doctor, right? You're director / doctor.
I learned Tyler a Norwood. Lot, but I yeah,
MD,
I'm not a
Tyler
doctor.
Norwood, MD.
I have no medical experience that I can cite in terms of anything other than just personal research for the film.
Right. Do you have hung out with the American Brain Foundation, right? Like that's
today.
Yeah, like what
as well.
What happens at the American Brain Foundation? Tell us about that.
Well, they have a fund going, and if you're going to ask me to plug them, they have a fund going, and we have a link to it on the film's website, which is a fund that's administered by Susan towards finding a biomarker. So far they've raised $5 million, and they're really excited about the work that's being done just on Lewy body dementia over at the American Brain Foundation. So they're very, very cool.
Yeah. That's awesome. It's pretty incredible. I mean, to hear that this disease is always fatal, like
deadly.
That's to me. I don't quite understand. Like, what is the? How do you die from it? What does your body just shut down eventually, and just your organs don't work, and you stop eating? Like, what's the fatal part of it?
Right. So with Alzheimer's, which my grandfather had, it's a neurological disease, right? These are all neurological diseases. And imagine a big umbrella, and there's all these different little like things in it. But the big umbrella is neurological disease. So that means your nervous system, right, which your brain is the captain of. As it starts breaking down in your brain, as that starts happening, you start having less and less control over yourself and your speech and the way you are in the world and your even your bowel function. Like all of these crazy things are changed. Like your brain's in control of everything. You are just a 3.5-pound hunk of meat. And if it goes wrong, like you're done. And so the idea that like the way that the last stage of this is your nervous system fails. That's the very end of this. So the reason he's having tremors at the very end of this is because the next thing that's going to start happening is his arm's not going to work. And then he's not going to be able to walk anymore. And then he's not going to be able to breathe anymore at some point after that. And that's the last moment.
Oh,
right. Like your core, like lizard brain functions, right? That like starts that deteriorates, like the things that keep your physiologically going.
Yeah. So if the brain is here, Lewy body dementia starts here and works its way out and then down, right? Parkinson's kind of starts like this and goes that way. That's the simplest way I've been able to describe it. But this is all on radio, so no one saw that, right?
couldn't hear it. Right now I'm making
If only we're on radio. If only we're on radio, yeah.
Right. Oh,
this is a pterodactyl.
Yeah.
I think it's like when I worked at that bookstore on Haight Street, Robin would come in about once a month and he would buy like $200 worth of books each time. He'd have this like stack of books. I think he was really into airplanes. I think he had a big airplane thing because he'd always buy these like World War II airplane.
Oh, he was so into World War II. Just a quick little thing as a fan that was fun to find out. This dude loved video games. And the one one video game he would always play was some World War II like fighter video game where he's in like a plane and like his wife would be like, they have this place called like the fun pit or something like that. And it was just this room in the house with like a giant couch and a huge TV. And like, he would just sit there for hours. And she was like, he liked fighting the little Chinese kids because they were the best at the game. And so he'd get up at weird hours to go play online with the Chinese kids. Cause they like, he would like, that's where he'd get his most challenging aerial battles. And I was like, that's fucking great.
That
like,
is awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. I know he named his daughter Zelda after the video game. So like, I heard that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But they have a framed copy of some video game in their house that was like, that was his shit. Like that was his, like if he's,
World of Warcraft or something.
No, it's all these World War II things. That was, in those last years of his life, like he was just on this, like, and the game was like, that he was playing was from like 2010. And like, so he's playing it like for years, way after it's a hot new game. He's just like,
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, it's, such a again, it's such a crazy story that it's definitely people who want to know more about Robin should watch this documentary, because it really does like help lay out the facts of like what was happening in his head and his body and his life, his career. Like, it all kind of seemed to come. It's not like he was retired, you know, and spending his time just like fishing. And then like this happened, like the dude was like making movies and a TV show. And all of a sudden it's like, you know, I'm not me anymore. What the fuck is happening? So it's really compelling, you know? So that makes Robin's Wish such a great documentary. I'm so glad that you're able to put it together. And it's awesome too that you're a local, you know, like that you're a local to the area and that you got easy. I don't know if you got easy. Did you get easy access to people or was it kind of difficult?
No.
Yeah.
No, this is anybody who knew stuff about this felt a lot of shame about like the secret and who should know. Oh. And like, and they loved Robin too. So it's like, who are you? Right. And yeah. It's like, well, Susan sent me and they're like, all right, like, okay. What do you got to show me? And I will say, like, the cool thing is, like, for people who are listening to this who are aspiring filmmakers or whatever, it's like, there was no slick Hollywood agent. There was no, like, back door into, like, you know, getting Sean Levy or David E. Kelly or any of these other people to participate. I had to make a film, and then I had to show it to them, and I had to say, you would fit in here and here and here. Those are the things that are currently being covered by Susan that we think you could do a better job on because you were on set, or like you would have had better access to this part of the story. Mm. And that was the thing that worked. It wasn't that I had some big agent. It wasn't that like I was saying like, I know Susan, and they all like parted the seas. It was like they were like, Susan's fantastic, but like Robin was my friend. Robin is the guy I worked with. Like Robin was, you know, it's like – We need to make a particularly personal agreement about you doing Robin justice that I can't base on anything other than you showing me something.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So you had to basically show them like a rough cut, like an outline. Like, yeah. Like,
yeah. So I had to go make a movie before I could make the movie.
Right. Oh, geez. Wow. Yeah. That's
how it works.
Is it? Is that pretty typical?
I think that's how it should work. I mean, it felt really good to me. Like, I was like, yeah. You know what? In the end of the day, like, I, of course, trust me, I sent the emails and I wish they would have just been like, no problem.
Yeah.
Right. Like, but it was like, you know, that
Tyler Norwood.
Chase is half the fun.
Come on in.
Yeah. The Tyler Norwood?
Weren't you on SupDoc once? I think that's probably what they were thinking. This guy was on SupDoc.
Didn't you drink warm beer at a bar in Oakland?
so warm. That was the beer was so warm.
So, Tyler, where can people find the film? This is coming out on Monday.
Tuesday, September 1st. It's going to be on iTunes, all the streaming platforms. And as of today, we also got another endorsement from USA Today saying that we're one of the other than Mulan, they said that we're the Ooh. Second most exciting thing to view to stream this fall. So I was like,
nice.
I'll take second seat to Mulan.
Holla. Hell yeah, you will. That's so. Yeah. What else do you have coming up for you? Are you going to take some?
Yeah,
time
Sky
off
Dojo. Or? Tell us about what's the Sky Dojo scene like these days?
Well, so Sky Dojo does all of our commercial work. So that's where we do stuff with like Facebook and Google and Adobe and whoever else. But Quotable Pictures is something that me and Ben, my friend and producer, started, and so we've got some development deals in place. But a lot of it has really been affected by COVID in terms of like what can move forward, what's even possible anymore. And it's like, can we do this whole show over Zoom instead? And it's like, so
right.
That part is like, that part's pretty intense, but you know, we'll all figure out a way around it. Cause we all want to tell stories and that's what we care about.
That is it, man. Well, thank you for telling, Robin's story. Thanks for bringing this to us, being back on SupDoc, Tyler. It's awesome to see you, buddy. And, thank you again.
Cool. Thanks and thank you for watching an early cut of this and giving us some really important feedback.
Oh, I loved it. I fucking loved it. I loved it. And anything with that has Robin Williams involved is like for me just a cherished thing because I loved him so much. So it was awesome to see an early cut.
Cool, man.
Yeah. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks a lot.
Goodbye.
Absolutely. See you guys.
Thanks for listening. You can find out more about SupDoc at supdocpodcast.com, recapping reality since 2015.
Our theme song was written by David Siegel, and our show was engineered by Will Scoville. Our associate producer is Nick Kultus.
Please donate to the show through our Patreon page, patreon.com/supdocpodcast. And if you want to help us out in any other way, please just share the show with a friend.
Join the Doc Talk and check out our hot takes, pictures, and videos on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. We're SupDoc Podcast on all of those platforms.
And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts.
You can find Paco and George's comedy gigs, when those are happening again, on the About Us page on the site.
SupDoc is by Doc fans for Doc fans. So if you want to advertise with SupDoc, or if you got a film or opinions, or if you want us to have a certain guest on, please hit us up.
We'd love to hear from you and what you're docking out on. Email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.